It didn't imagine it will grow that much. I was thinking maybe this is going to be one of those hipster frameworks that 50 people around the world rave about and no one else knows what they are talking about. And so many things that I never even imagined. They are like simulating galaxies using the great building blocks that are already there, that are built by great people, and just like figuring out how to combine those things together to take advantage of like all the things, all the powerful things that are already there. It's very cool to meet your heroes. If you don't go to the university, I didn't go, and I would like to say I'm fine, I guess. And it just keeps happening. Like, I keep seeing like new job. Like when I had like 3.5 years of having built FastAPI, they were requesting 5 years of experience with FastAPI.
Why is FastAPI so popular? To find out, I spoke with its creator, Sebastian Ramirez, also known as Tiangolo. Sebastian has built FastAPI, Typer, SQL Module, and many other open source tools. He's also the founder of FastAPI Labs, where he and his team are building FastAPI Cloud, a new way to deploy FastAPI apps. We talked about the rise of FastAPI, what's on the roadmap, how recent Python performance work affects it, the story behind his company, what Sebastian thinks about software developers, and even how he deals with negative comments online.
FastAPI is one of the fastest growing Python frameworks. According to the JetBrains survey 2023, in 2021 it was used by 14% of responders. In 2023, it was 25% of responders. What made it so popular?
I don't know. I think I wasn't trying to make a popular thing. I was just trying to solve some problems that I wanted solved when building APIs, when building web APIs. And I wanted to make it in a way that was what I wanted to have when I was learning how to do these things and when I was building these types of applications before. I always had a strong focus on making it super approachable and super easy to learn while having like all the best practices or at least good defaults by default, so that people could write some application and they will have something that is very, very sensible and pretty much production ready from the get-go, while at the same time being able just to understand what is happening and what they are doing. So I was trying to not expect any background or experience and make it super approachable. I think that probably helped that people ended up liking it and just like sharing it with each other and like, hey, this thing is like quite easy to learn, quite easy to use, and like it works quite well. And then they ended up liking it, like, and just like sharing it among developers. And I think that's probably like the main thing.
So
that
developer experience was basically a priority for you.
Yes, definitely. It's always been like a, I don't know, probably like the top priority. Yeah. Like the developer experience, the documentation.
And what are some of the challenges working on such a popular project? Because you mentioned that you build a tool for yourself and you never wanted to build a tool that would become so popular. It just happened that you built it for yourself, you made it available for everyone and people just started using it. So what are some challenges or surprising things that you didn't expect?
It's quite interesting that like, I mean, I was hoping it was gonna be useful, and I was targeting myself as, you know, like when I was a little bit younger and like when I was, I don't know, like a kid sort of trying to learn these things. So I wanted to make it approachable, but I didn't imagine it would grow that much. I was thinking maybe this is gonna be one of those hipster frameworks that 50 people around the world rave about and no one else knows what they are talking about. But then it just like kept growing, and like I never expected. I mean, it surprises me all the time to see like how much it's grown and like what people are using it for. And it's like, wow, that's so cool. I mean, for me, that's super cool. Also, when, you know, like when someone just like comes and approaches me and says like, hey, thank you. Like, thanks to FastAPI, I have my job, or like I do my things, or I was able to, yeah, I don't know, like solve the problem I needed to solve, or like hit the deadline, or like pass the test in the university, or, you know, like, or deploy the most sophisticated machine learning models. And I'm like, that's so cool. That's so amazing. It has a bunch of, I guess, unexpected challenges as well. And they also like evolve through time. So at first it was just like, I don't know, chatting with some people on GitHub on GitHub issues, figuring out what people are doing it with the tool and like how to make the thing work better for everyone. But then at some point when it passes a certain size, it's also just like a lot of people using it. And sometimes people come and just like ask, how do I use it for this very specific use case? And it's just right. So many people asking that I can't go
you can
personally.
You can't scale yourself.
Yeah.
You need a team
and
or a
exactly,
community.
Exactly. And then figuring out what is the right way to attract people to come and help and like how to incentivize that. And then also like, you know, like how to maintain everything, how to, you know, like the problem starts changing and growing. And it's very interesting because it's quite different how it was 2 months after launching the thing to what it is now, like all the process that is involved and everything. But it's very fun.
So you mentioned community. Fast API has been translated to over 20 languages, which is obviously done by the community. Why do you think that community likes to contribute to Fast API? You mentioned some incentives and you spend lots of time thinking about how to make it attractive for the community to contribute. What are your thoughts about it?
I guess I have weird and probably controversial thoughts about like community and the word community, because I think in many cases people treat the word community as like, I don't know, a separate entity that sustains on its own and makes things work and makes things happen. And like, I feel community is normally specific individuals doing the work. You know, like you cannot say that, you know, like, the community will take care of organizing EuroPython. And then there's a handful of people doing a lot of the work. And like, it will like, you know, like much more hands helping do the work will be very much welcome. But it's not as obvious that, you know, like it's very specific individuals.
There's not equal distribution. So if you have 10 people, everyone does 20%, but it's like very uneven.
Yes. In many cases, there's a small amount of people doing a lot of the work and a large amount of people sort of consuming the work. Mm. And like, this is also great that, you know, like there's people using the things, people attending to the conferences. But I think it's important to have in mind also the specific people doing the work. So for example, in Fast API, one of the things that consumes, I guess, like most of the time on the work is not writing Python code, it's answering discussions in GitHub discussions. Yeah. There are so many questions and people come and they ask in many cases about their own problems and like their own bugs. Sometimes they confuse their own bugs with bugs in the framework and then like guiding them through like, what is the process? That is a lot of effort. And then what I did is I set up a thing in the Fast API documentation to highlight the people that come and help with that. So there's a whole section of Fast API people and there are the Fast API experts. Those are the ones that are helping others with their questions. And this is computed automatically every month and just like updated. And then you can see like who are the people that are helping others. And like these are the Fast API, these are the official Fast API experts. And you can also go and see, it's there on the website, on the docs, and you can see who are these people. And you can also see that it's a bunch of people. It's not like a large amount of people. It's just like, it's a handful. It's a bunch of people just doing a lot of the work and helping a lot others. I think, you know, like things like that, highlighting this work, making it visible, making it, you know, trying to, it's a tiny thing, but it's at least some type of incentive or reward or something, at least to acknowledge all that work that is done. You know, like, yeah.
Yes. And what is the current roadmap of Fast API? It's still on the 0.x releases. Is there any Fast API 1.0 coming with big changes? Or are there mostly smaller features and bug fixes?
There's definitely a 1.something coming. The thing is, it's actually super simple. At some point, there's going to be like some 250 or whatever. And then the next one will be 1.0 and the different, and there will be no difference whatsoever. And that will be just like a point of like, okay, yeah, there's not much things to change here. The reason why I haven't done that is because Fast API has some internal components that are supposed to be internal, that are not documented. They are not for people to be tweaking them. But I don't have them very explicitly hidden. I don't have them, you know, like with names that start with underscore to try to mark them like, hey, this is private. Don't fiddle with this. And then there are some extra packages that are built on top of Fast API or around Fast API or modifying Fast API that go and tweak into that and like monkey patch things here and there. And there's no very clear, you know, definition of what are the things, what are the extension points or what not. So people just like go on monkey patch, you know, like, not people in general, just like some specific packages that are extending or something, monkey patch things in different ways. And there's not a lot of clarity of what are the things that are necessary for others to extend. Or like, what are the supported ways to extend things? What I want to do is make these things that need to be made private, make them private, make a release with that. Some things are going to break and people are going to come and complain about it. And then I can very quickly make a second release, making those things public again, or figuring out what is the way to expose that functionality for people to use, or like, what will be the right way to do this type of thing? If I did that, just making a, oh, here's 1.0.0 that has a bunch of breaking changes, I will have to make 2.01 week after, and like then 3 and then 4, just to, you know, like deal with that, we deal with that stuff. So it's mainly practical purposes. FastAPI is already tested, has 100% test coverage. It's used by like, I don't know, like most of the companies. It's used to control particle accelerators at the same, like the Large Hadron Collider.
That's really amazing.
Yeah, and scary at the same time.
And you never imagined probably it becomes so popular.
No, not at all. Never. And it's very humbling and satisfying to see what people are doing with it and like what people can achieve with that. And so many things that I never even imagined. They are like simulating galaxies and discovering, like, I don't know, that there was like thing that they were simulating galaxies at supercomputers like Carnegie Mellon, and that led to a proposal to observe in the Webb Space Telescope, so a thing in the space, to observe the first quasar. And it's like, I have no idea what that means. It sounds very cool, but I have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
Like being able to power so many people to do more stuff and like, you know, like help each other and like help people around and help society and make money and like, you know, like all that is like, it's super cool.
And that's very inspiring to be able to build tools that are used for such cool things, like for example, for space kind of things.
Yes. It's I don't know. It's very cool. Oh, look, for example, ChatGPT, OpenAI, that's all FastAPI internally. It's like, wait, like these images that I'm generating are actually using a bunch of FastAPI internally. That's super cool.
One of the reasons why people use FastAPI because it's faster than other Python frameworks. I'm wondering, how closely are you following discussions in the Python core team regarding Python's performance? Nowadays, there are lots of discussions about, for example, optional interpreters, no-gil Python. How do you think that those changes will impact FastAPI?
I'm pretty sure it will like just make things better transparently. In FastAPI, I don't really do much sophisticated stuff to make things faster. It's just that FastAPI uses very high performance, low level stuff underneath. So FastAPI uses Pydantic for the data processing, data validation, serialization, documentation. And the core of Pydantic is written in Rust.
The second version.
The second version, yes. And then it uses Starlet for the web parts. And it's served normally with Ubicorn. And Ubicorn, if you started install it with the standard dependencies, uses UV Loop underneath, which is a high-performance drop-in replacement for async I/O. And this uses libuv, that is the C library for handling event loops and async I/O. And, you know, like async stuff. It's the same one that is used in Node.js. So you can get like the same concurrency that you will get in Node.js. So it's like, you know, just like using the great building blocks that are already there, that are built by great people, and just like figuring out how to combine those things together to take advantage of like all the things, all the powerful things that are already there. Now I have the extra advantage of, you know, like knowing a few core developers that are always super friendly and like, you know, like, I don't know. Sometimes, for example, Judy is a Libano was telling me, hey, I'm working on this and this will have like, you know, like shared memory within sub interpreters and it's crazy stuff, but it is going to be super cool and useful for FastAPI. Like, oh, this is amazing. It's like, now it's just like a lot of privilege and like, and it's also very fun to talk to them and like, I don't know, like Lucas was saying like, ah, I'm going to see the talk from my friend Tiangola. And he's like, he called me friend.
That's so cute.
I'm so proud. You know, like, it's very cool to, I think it's very cool to meet your heroes and like see that they are so kind and to, I don't know, it's very nice.
But it's also very cool for other people to meet their heroes, and you're inspiring to lots of people. So we met at the speaker's dinner at EuroPython, and there was a guy who said he's a first-time attendee, and we were standing there, and he told us, like, you know what, there's a keynoter, Sebastian Ramirez, I would really like to see him. And you were sitting behind, and one of the organizers said, like, okay, this no problem, you will get a photo with him, and he just stood up and went to you and asked you for a selfie, and the guy got a selfie with you. So
that was
how does it feel to be so popular?
it's very strange. Like, you know, like I enjoy it a lot, having like all the friendly conversations and like all the, you know, like all this friendliness. That's amazing. I think that helps a lot, and like that energizes a lot. In many cases, when you're dealing with code and you're dealing with GitHub and like things like that, people come with their problems and with their frustration at the moment. And in many cases, they are like, annoyed at something. And then like you're dealing with a lot of all their annoyance and frustration. It's like, you know, like, it's like sometimes that part is like, oh, heavy or draining, you know? And then like having these spaces is like a great balance, because people come and tell you, hey, FastAPI is very cool. Like, I use it for this or for that and things like that. And you know, like I enjoy a lot having like all these conversations with a lot of people, and like feeling that this feeling of like, hey, I did something that is actually useful. That's great. That motivates a lot. And like, yeah, I don't know.
And do you ever receive any angry messages? I know that there was a big discussion about the bus factor in FastAPI, and there was an issue with lots of people just being angry or frustrated, and lots of comments that were not so friendly. Do you also ever receive the opposite, people just sending you some angry messages or anything like that? And how do you deal with that?
Yes, I receive it. I think probably the first angry, you know, like, one thing is people that are annoyed and that are bitter and that are, what is the word? I don't know, unpolite.
Mm-hmm.
But that maybe have some part of like, that you can understand at least what they are thinking. And probably those are the things that hurt the most, because it's like, I kind of understand, but like they are being very aggressive and like they are damaging you emotionally, you know. And like when people post online, they post like on many different platforms and things, and in many cases people post stuff as, I don't know, like maybe they feel like no one will see them and they can just be like super aggressive. And
well,
like,
of course, because on the internet everyone is anonymous.
Exactly.
You would not approach a person and tell them straight
exactly
to your face what people write on the
internet.
And
I don't know if they know that you always end up reading those messages, even if you don't go and reply, and you read that, you
so
see that.
You don't
that,
have your PR team. You read all the messages.
Oh
yourself.
Yes, I read all the I post everything. Like, I don't know if like there will be so many emojis if I have a PR team. It's just, that's just myself. Like whenever like you see like a post by me or by FastAPI, that's me. That's just me writing. But like, you know, like those are annoying sometimes and hit. And like, it's funny that 90% of the people are amazing, are super mm-hmm friendly and are great, and only 10% of the people are bitter and like, I don't know, like trying to damage or things. But those 10% hit hard. That's hit quite a bit, and it's like draining.
And did you learn how not to take it personally? Because sometimes people are just having a bad day, they're angry,
yeah,
or whatever, and it's not personal, just the object of their frustration.
Yeah, and like you try to not take it personally, and like you say on the talks, don't take it personally, and just
but
like go on with your life. But then like doing it is another thing. Of course, trying to do it, like I think you definitely should not take it personally. In most of the cases, you should just not engage at all, because the attention that you give is a reward, for positive or for negative.
And it costs you energy.
And costs you energy. But also it's a reward for the person. You reply to someone saying nasty stuff about you, and that gets more visibility just because you replied. And then like more people will engage and then like or dislike what they said and then what you said. And it's just like a lot of bitterness and negative energy for you.
And time wasted.
And negative emotion, yes, for you, for the other person, and like for the people that is getting involved. And a lot of people just getting pissed about one thing or another. So if there's actually nothing that is really important, or there's nothing that is like a lot of people just getting like angry with that specific thing, in many cases, it's not worth just like handling it. But there are cases where you just have to handle it. For example, when people are being aggressive, demeaning, or things like that towards others and like others in your community. Yeah,
because
like,
you have to protect your community.
Yes, it's your community.
People would stop contributing.
It's your community. You have to protect it. You are responsible for that. It's like, it's your thing. It's like, you cannot say, like, no, I don't like conflict. I will let them deal with that. It's too late. Like, you have to defend the thing, and you have to defend your people and like keep the toxic people away. So like, yeah, that's definitely a thing. But, that's the other thing. When you engage with people in other spaces where they are nice, or like in conferences, and like people are just being nice, that revitalizes you and like re-energizes you.
All the bones.
Yes, and that compensates
makes
a lot.
Makes you feel better, yeah.
Definitely. And there's also, so those are the ones that are hard, but then there are others that are just crazy angry and saying very nasty stuff to you and like being like extremely bitter and like, you know, like disproportionate. Those are very fun because, you know, like they are just like, you know, like how could I, by my plain existence, damage so much this person? It's like, I didn't know I was so important, you know, like why would make this person say so many bad words in an email? It's like, sure, I don't know. So those end up just being like actually funny because it just doesn't make any sense. But like, yeah, I guess it's like trying to find that trade-off and try to find that balance and acknowledging that when you don't affect anyone whatsoever, like you probably won't get any positive or any negative. When you affect a bit of people, hopefully in a very positive way, you will get like positive stuff. And when you start affecting more and more people, hopefully in a mainly positive way, some people will also affect in some negative way. And as the more you grow, the more coverage you have of random people. And some of those random people will be annoying and like they will just come. And I think it's important to try to treat that as success. You know, like if you are being able to make a lot of people happy and help a lot of people, but at the same time, for whatever reason, you are being able to make some random people so angry about you and what you do, it's like, that's, I guess, like the best is just to take it as a proof of success and that the thing that you are building is having such a big impact that ends up being important for someone that shouldn't care about it. They should just like say like, I don't like it. I will just like use this other thing. But they, I don't know if they feel threatened by the existence of this thing that maybe they consider it so big that they feel like they are forced to do it and use it when they don't want to. Or I don't know. I don't really know what drives that. But just like trying to think about it, like, okay, it's just like having a huge impact and they're just saying like, okay, this is probably a success, and trying to focus on the people that you can help and the positive impact that you can create. I think at least the point of view can help a bit too. Overcome those other sides.
Recently, you announced a new project. You're building Fast API Cloud. You also founded a new company behind that called Fast API Labs. What was your motivation behind that?
It was a combination of things. I think it was very similar to Fast API or SQL Model or Typer that I was avoiding doing that. For these projects, I was avoiding building them and I was trying to find the tool that was solving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then I figured, okay, there's no tool that is solving it, at least not in the way that I need. I'm just going to build it.
What is the way it is that the current tools are, what is the way they're solving it and what is the way how you would like it to work?
Yeah, for example, for Fast API, I wanted to use type annotations. And the current tools available, for example, Flask and Django, that did a great job and like I learned a lot from them. They were designed before type annotations existed. They were designed before async and array existed. So they didn't have a way to design the framework to take advantage of that. And I wanted to take advantage of these tools. So it was like, okay, how can I, is there something that can do this? There's nothing. Okay, let's go and build it.
And for FastAPI Cloud?
And for FastAPI Cloud, it was, I have always been on the side of, it's better just to teach how to use things instead of using them. And like, I have like this sort of internal, benchmark or trade-off or like whatever to figure out when it actually makes sense to build something new. In most of the cases, for, and you can see that in the FastAPI documentation, I try to explain how to use the lower level tools. And for example, in the sections about authentication, I currently explain how to handle passwords, how to hash them, how to verify them, how to do all the stuff with the plain packages. Without, it doesn't, it's not necessary to create a FastAPI plugin for handling or like, or something like that. You can just like use the tools right there and just like learn how to use them. But when they are so complex and it's just like very complex, very cumbersome, error prone, difficult to learn, those underlying tools, I feel it makes sense to have a simpler or more convenient abstraction on top to make things a little bit easier.
And did this come from you or from customers? Was there any demand? There were some commercial entities, for example, who said, this is what we want. If you build it, we are going to be your customers. Or is it more like you for your personal projects or in general, you wanted to build a product and you felt like, okay, this is the right thing and I will find the customers afterwards?
For most of the, and for, I mean, for most of the things that I have built, and definitely for the things that I have built that have been successful, is solving a problem for myself. Solving is actually just like trying to improve my own developer experience. My own developer experience as a developer, not as a maintainer. I take a lot of extra effort on the maintainer side just so that when I use the tool, I have a much better experience. It's the same with this. Figuring out like, you know, like right now, the main big thing to deploy stuff is Kubernetes, and this is just like so massive and it's like just so,
it's very complex.
Yes, it's quite complex. And like, I mean, yes, it's great, but like if you're building an application, you shouldn't have to spend months learning a lot of extra stuff to just like deploy the application. And then like the alternatives would also there are some other great products building like cloud abstractions on top of lower level primitives, let's say. But in many cases, they also trying to generalize to different frameworks and different languages. And then you're not learning Kubernetes, you're learning a bunch of extra configs and files and how to tweak this and how to make things work. And in the end, it's again a lot of tweaking and handling and like trying to make the thing actually work. And it's just a lot of effort in figuring out what is the right way to get everything correctly. And, you know, like with a lot of uncertainty, like, is this actually properly done or not? And I didn't like that. I didn't like that I could teach someone that just took a Python course and I could take them and in 1 week or two, just read the whole FastAPI docs and then they are an API developer. They can know how to do these things. But then to deploy it is like, okay, you're on your own. Figure it out. It's like, why did I took them just like, you know, like all the path through all the mountain to then leave them at the cliff right at the end. I didn't have a way to tell people, this is how you can now deploy your API. A simple way, it's something that will have like everything good by default. So I wanted that thing to exist. And also, it has a very nice property, let's say, that is like FastAPI Cloud. It's a commercial product, it's private, whatever.
So your plan is to go, FastAPI is now open source. Keep it open source.
Oh, yes.
FastAPI Cloud is a commercial product that would be only for customers to pay for it.
Yes. And FastAPI, you can already deploy it however you want. It's all open source. It's based on standards.
But it's not as easy as you would like it to be.
It's currently not as easy. I mean, not for FastAPI. Just deploying anything is not as easy as I would like it to be. Deploying any programming language, any application in any system is not that easy to deploy things.
And how is this going to work when you have many customers and those customers have different environments, they use different tools? So is FastAPI Cloud, is it supposed to support different environments, different versions, or is it supposed to work only with Kubernetes, or is it something like a platform as a service where you would have, where customers could deploy their FastAPI lab and it would live on somewhere on some server?
So the first thing that we are targeting is small developers, startups, team inside of companies that want to have like something very simple, very easily deployed, and like have it like deployed with all the bells and whistles, like how to scale everything, and then figure out how customers are using the product and what else do we need to build.
So do you provide them only with the tools how to deploy it, or do you also provide them with hosting?
The main thing is the hosting. When people install FastAPI, they have a command line FastAPI, and they can say FastAPI dev to run the development server, or FastAPI run to run the production server.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to deploy it in any other cloud, they will use the same FastAPI run in, I don't know, like a Docker container deployed in some Kubernetes or some cloud provider.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. Now they're also going to have a command in FastAPI deploy. This takes the application, sends it to our cloud. We do all the stuff that needs to be done. And it's so much stuff that needs to be done. And then we give you back an HTTPS URL with your thing already deployed, or with your custom domain if you have one. And then we handle building, installing, deploying HTTPS, auto-scaling based on requests. So it even can scale down to zero, so you can like save on costs. Like, you know, like all
and
the...
And what if I have a database? Can it be deployed somewhere else? For example, if I want to keep my data inside my company, or does it have to be coupled with the FastAPI application itself?
We want to hyper-focus on just FastAPI. And for databases, we are partnering and making integrations with database providers that are just like focused on having like great developer experience and like a great product for databases. So we are just trying to like bring like who can do the best for each one of these key pieces for the system. And then us focus on just having like what is the best developer experience that we can have for FastAPI, and have like the best, you know, like sensible defaults for everyone, just to be able to build as easily as possible.
What is one of the weirdest bugs that you have ever come across when working in open source or building all your tools?
A weird bug.
Or maybe surprising?
One thing that was very difficult is SQL Model is this library that I have for interacting with SQL databases, and also at the same time using that for data validation and data serialization. So it combines two libraries underneath. One is SQL Alchemy, the other one is Pydantic. And then SQL Model, the code in SQL Model is actually not long. It's quite short. But finding that exact code was so, so difficult. Because Pydantic is able to do very sophisticated and fancy stuff so that developers can have an amazing developer experience that is super simple. But then Pydantic has to do internal stuff underneath that is very complex to make all that work. And so it's a lot of modern black magic. And then SQL Alchemy also does a bunch of stuff to make things work, and also has a lot of things that required backward compatibility with, since it was created, that is like a long time ago. So it has a lot of old black magic. Then combining old black magic with modern black magic, that was very complicated. And at some point, for example, the way that SQL, maybe it's like too technical detail, but anyway, the way that SQL Alchemy works is that when you create an instance, it will call the init method. But then when you inherit from SQL Alchemy, it will override that init method and will create a new one that does all the fancy stuff. But then if it does all the fancy stuff, you cannot override this init method to do all the stuff that needs to be done in Pydantic. And now there are ways that you can connect into the classes and how they work internally to define this sort of magic, let's say. And Pydantic have ways to do this sort of magic. But then that is not compatible with this old way of doing things. So then I had to do a bunch of tricks and make the internals of the thing. It should be initialized in this way, or it should be partially initialized so that then it can be the initialization can be finalized. Like, you know, like, it's like, oh, that was
so many different use cases that you have to cover.
Yeah. And then it's a lot of just because the tools were not designed for like, just go and like expose the guts of it and like make new things so that they were designed for their specific use cases. So all this stuff is not documented. So it's just developing through the debugger to see what is happening. So it's like that one was very, very difficult. It's like, who am I thinking I am to think I can just like go and like understand and do this? But yeah, anyway, like in the end, it worked.
It sounds
like
fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
You're the creator of one of the most popular Python frameworks, and you're a self-taught developer, right?
Yes.
What are your thoughts about college degrees and education nowadays?
I think, first, what is most important is solving a problem and focusing on solving a problem and learning stuff to be able to solve the problem. To solve the problem, you need to have tools and you need to learn them and learn how to use them. There are many ways to learn what are the things that you need to build and to solve problems. One of those ways is college, university, and like if they have good materials, if they are teaching you good stuff and like they are doing it in a good way so that you can actually understand instead of just like getting overwhelmed with some like, I don't know, old teaching style or something, then that's great. And if you can afford it. Also, and if you have like the chance to go to the university that you want to go or like that, the point is the quality and the value that you get from that study is actually great study. If you don't go to the university, I didn't go and I would like to say I'm fine, I guess. In particular, when you are dealing with computers, you can learn most of the stuff online. Actually, from universities. I took a bunch of online courses from Stanford, Berkeley, MIT, and a bunch of these places have a lot of the information available. The same professors, the same exams, the same everything. It's just free online, and you can actually study it. So I think it's key, it's super important to study and to learn stuff. And like, I keep studying and I keep learning stuff. And like, I'm still today studying stuff all the time and learning, trying to learn all the time. And it's a nonstop thing. That's also one of the things that happens with universities. Sometimes people feel like, okay, I'm just going to study for 2 years, 6 years, I don't know how many, and like, then I'm done. And now I have
never
like,
ends.
Yes. Now I have this title that says that I studied that thing, so I don't have to study ever again. And like, that's not true.
The world is evolving very fast. Lots of new technologies, techniques.
Yes. And in particular, dealing with computers, in many cases, it evolves faster than how fast many educational institutions keep the pace on. So you just really have to be ready to be studying all the time. And also without like having like a very structured guidance and like just like going reading the documentation and figuring out what is the thing that you need to learn.
But sometimes some companies want you to have a degree. And I remember that once you commented there was a job requirement to have 4 years of experience with FastAPI for regular Python developer position. But that happened when FastAPI existed for a year and a half only.
Yes. Yes. And it just keeps happening. Like I keep seeing like new job. Like when I had like 3.5 years of having built FastAPI, they were requesting 5 years of experience with FastAPI. Like what
is
it? Yes, yeah. It's So the thing is, in many cases, one of the only indicators some people have, recruiters or I don't know, of like how good a person is for something is like how many years has this person been doing that? And like, but I think it's a very bad indicator. It's just, you know, like,
yeah, it doesn't tell you anything about the quality of their work, about their motivation.
Yes. And like, you can take one person and this person has been working in computers and like doing stuff for 10 years. And maybe those 10 years, this person was working exactly in the same thing, the same feature, working on it over and over again, not changing anything, just like making sure that it keeps working. Just, you know, like taking care of the, in one of these large corporations and taking care of the little button in the top right corner. That is the thing that they do and they have been doing for years. Yes, they have years of experience, but how useful is that experience if you're not learning new things? And at the same time, you get like, some person that has been working for 1 or 2 years in a startup and got to learn like front end and back end and how to debug and also like how to write documentation and how to talk to people. And I feel those 2 years of experience with that might be much more valuable than the 10 years handling one single button in the current. So I feel like years of experience, I don't think it's a great indicator. Like, you should be evaluating skills and what is the value that you can have from someone. I also don't like, I don't think a university degree or like something should be the main thing, the main filter. I think that doesn't really make sense. Even more in our field, that like you just need to be learning so much stuff. I mean, if you can get a university degree and you can go and like get a PhD or whatever, like that's great. Great for you. Like, you just probably learned a lot and you had to deal with a lot of stuff. And that's great.
But it's not necessary.
Yeah, and it's not the only indicator that you're actually good at the stuff that you are doing. There are things that can be a more important indicator, like the code that you write, and like maybe if you have done like open source stuff and like, you know, things like that. So I think it will be better to be able to evaluate more the specific skills and the things that you can actually achieve than what are the, you know, like the list of fancy things that you can put on their resume.
Someone would like to contribute to Fast API or one of the tools that you've created, how to get involved?
There's quite a bunch of documentation in the Fast API docs of how to get involved and how to help. There are multiple ways. The main way is probably helping with questions from others. This, on one hand, it helps a lot, the project. It helps the repo because like there are so many questions, it's very difficult to handle it. It also makes the person that is helping a Fast API expert. If you answer, I don't know, like 10 questions in a month, you're probably going to be in the top 10 for in the top people for that month. It's not even that much. But like, you know, like helping with that helps a lot. It will also force you to try to understand what people are trying to do and trying to help them debug their own code. And will also teach you a lot about how people are using things. And it will also teach you how Fast API works. I think the main thing will probably be reading the docs. They are not long and they are written like as a tutorial to try to explain you everything that you need to learn, everything that can be done with Fast API. It shouldn't be like too long and it's designed to be short. It's like there's a lot of work to make them short. Understanding how Fast API works, that will be the first step, and then helping others with that. That will also at some point end up showing you some type of bug or something that actually makes sense that it shouldn't be working that way or some features that could work. And then that's probably the point where you will think like, okay, maybe it makes sense to try to contribute this to the repo. But it's probably that, you know, like gradual process. I think Savannah had a keynote yesterday explaining how she got into like contributing to CPython to the core and becoming a core developer. And like, I feel it's like that same process applies to most open source projects. So like, you know, let's start with triaging, like trying to help others with their problems, with their bugs. That's a great talk. So, people should watch it.
Yes. So documentation and helping others with the questions.
Yes.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It was super fun.